Not the sound you'd expect to hear at your recreational weekend tennis match, is it? Down at the local courts in your whites with a plate of pikelets? Maria Sharapova sure knows how to use her lungs at tournaments, which couldn't be further from the setting of famous tennis training hotbeds like Spartak in Moscow, which has spawned other top Russian players like Anna Kournikova and Marat Safin.
We instinctively think of talent as something you're born with, as a gift, some divine spark that you have in your genes. But that's not how the talent hotbeds treated it. They treated it as an act of construction. They treated it as a project. They treated it as something that took time and slow development, practice, 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 over and over, which sounds sort of like what our grandmothers used to tell us, that practice was important, that practice makes perfect. But where the science is really showing us something special, and it's that practice has sort of a neurological magic. It really is changing our brains. We're constructing a newer, faster set of reflexes when we practice in certain ways.
Natasha Mitchell with you. And on ABC Radio National's All in the Mind today, what does it take to be a world-class talent? And for the armchair champions amongst us, what can we all learn from world-class talents about our own potential? Maria Tickle has been doing some very deliberate practice.
It takes 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to make an expert. It's a claim that's been hauled out in locker rooms and at corporate lunches around the world for years. But why 10,000 hours, and what's deliberate practice? In a moment, you'll meet the Swedish psychologist whose research has been instrumental to the idea. But Minnesota-based journalist Dan Coyle, author of The Talent Code, has been doing some research of his own, starting at Spartak.
It was kind of a funny story because Spartak is located in this big park, which is different than our American or Australian concept of park. And in Moscow, it's more like a giant woods, forest. And so I'm walking through the forest with my interpreter looking for this club. And we finally came upon this place. It didn't look like a club. It looked like an old abandoned warehouse. And what's more, I didn't hear that thumping sound that you hear at tennis clubs, the sound of balls and rackets. And I figured we must be in the wrong place. And my interpreter assured me that we weren't, opened the door, and I saw that he was right. I was in the right place. They were swinging, but they weren't using the ball. They were swinging very, very slowly. It looked almost like a ballet class, very slow, precise swings that were being adjusted by the instructor. And they call it imitatsiya, a way of building a good swing. And that was my introduction to a new way of thinking about practice.
Is it true that the players that go through Spartak don't play a tournament for the first 3 years?
That's an in-house rule that they have. They don't play in a competitive tournament. They'll play among themselves. They'll sort of scrimmage. And the logic behind it is you need to build the skill. You need to build the swing before you subject it to the distorting pressures of competition. In America, I know, and perhaps in Australia, the first thing that you want to do as a parent or as a coach a lot of times is we instinctively want them to compete and play. But the way they look at the skill is different. The way they look at the skill, it's like they're building a circuit, and they need to build it properly before they put it under pressure. When you realize the amount of time it takes, you know, there's a great number that gets thrown around a lot, 10,000 hours, the rule of 10,000 hours. A scientific finding that says most world-class experts take 10,000 hours. Now, there's some debate over that number precisely, but it serves to underline a larger fact, which is all greats have to work really hard. And working really hard is not rational. It's not a common sense thing to do. It takes a certain amount of irrationality, a certain amount of, call it passion, call it love, call it craziness. But that is part of the ignition process. And it flows from our sense of identity. There's a lot of fascinating science out there that show how when you affect someone's identity, when their action of their sport or their passion or their art becomes linked to their identity, you tap into all kinds of energy that they can put into practice, that they can put into building that skill. And the sort of view that comes out of it is one, it's combinatorial. I mean, you need to have, it's not enough to practice in the right way by itself, and it's not enough just to be motivated in the right way by itself. You need both of those things together, and you find that in these hotbeds.
So this gets us on to what you call deep practice. It's also been called deliberate practice. What is it and how does it work?
It flows from the scientific finding that when you operate on the edge of your ability, on the very uncomfortable razor edge of your ability, your learning goes up. And it doesn't go up just a little. It increases quite a lot. There's a great term that gets used in this context. It's called learning velocity. We normally don't think of learning as having a velocity, but a lot of the science shows that it does. The rate at which you can learn increases greatly when you operate in what scientists call the sweet spot on the edge of your ability. And that means reaching for a specific target, for a certain type of motion, for a certain chord on a musical instrument, whatever task you're trying to do, reaching, failing, and reaching again. We normally think of that sort of struggle as being unproductive. We normally think of it as being a verdict on our ability, that we can't do it. But that is precisely the type of practice that I saw in the Talent Hotbeds. Actually, it came down to a certain face. I kept seeing this face over and over again, this same face, whether it was soccer or tennis or chess. And it was the face of Clint Eastwood, his nostril flaring, tense, like a six-mile gaze, a narrowed eyes, squinty look. It's the face of somebody reaching and then failing and then reaching again, because it's very uncomfortable to be in that emotional spot. It takes a certain amount of energy to stay there. And yet that's where how our brains are built to learn. Our brains are not built to learn by just sort of leaning back. Our brains are built to learn. Evolution has built us to learn when we're in this heightened intensity, reaching and failing and reaching again. And that's the construction act. That's new wires connecting in your brain. That's faster circuitry being built.
That is exactly the sort of practice you do here in gym. It's just constant repetition, just trying to get everything down to the finest detail of perfection. Some days that's a real struggle and it doesn't work, but just keep going and might keep falling, but eventually you nail that skill. And the feeling of when you do that is just the best that you get in this sport. My name's Georgia Wheeler and I'm a gymnast at the Victorian Women's High Performance Centre in Prahran.
And Georgia, a very determined 17-year-old, has just made the squad for the Australian team at next year's London Olympic Games.
I started gym when I was 7 years old. It's pretty intense most of the time, but you get into a habit, and because it's what you want to do, you just deal with it and get used to it and push through.
Georgia, do you think you were born with natural talent and ability when it comes to gymnastics, or has it been really about the hard work?
Well, I'm sure I've got like a little bit of talent in there somewhere, but a lot of it has been hard work. So I've always been athletic, and then with the gym I just persevered with it and pushed as hard as I could to get where I am now, and I will keep going until I achieve everything.
Is there a limit to how much deliberate practice one can do in a day? You say it's very intense.
It is, and one of the patterns that I saw was napping. I saw a lot of people napping at the hotbeds and in music and sport everywhere. And some scientists sort of theorize that there is a limit, that you can 3 to 4 to 5 hours a day seems to be the natural limit for the amount of hard, intensive, deliberate practice you can do, which seems sort of arbitrary until you think of it as a construction process. There's a limit to the amount of physical exercise a human can do. And this is sort of the equivalent of a mental exercise, where instead of building muscle, we're building wires in our brain. We're connecting. We're building something that is actually there inside your brain. And that takes a certain amount of energy, which implies something's going to limit it.
So is this the only kind of practice that matters then? Are we wasting our time if we're not working in this deep practice zone?
Some scientists would say exactly that. There's a fun moment that I had watching a videotape. It happened to be a clarinetist, and she played two songs in a row. And the first song she played in a very sloppy, shallow way. And the second song she played quite deliberately, quite deep practice, perfect practice. And the scientists had calculated, actually an Australian named Gary McPherson, who's quite a brilliant music historian, music psychologist rather, calculated that she did 10 times as much practice in that brief minute of the second song as she did in the first. And he was said, you know, she really should go out and play. You know, she should go out in the yard and kick a ball around, because she's wasting her time just sort of going through the motions and not stretching herself.
Nobody starts with deliberate practice, you know, for 4 hours. About 10 to 15 minutes seems to be that most people can actually sustain the concentration during those periods. So that would be kind of the starting point. So I'm Anders Ericsson, and I'm a professor of psychology at Florida State University that's located in Tallahassee, Florida, in the United States. I think I pretty much started studying exceptional performance in about 1978. And what seems to happen is that your ability here to sustain the time that you can engage in deliberate practice increases as a function of how much training and your skill level in that particular domain.
So the more expert you become at your skill, the more expert you become at this deliberate practice at the same time then.
Exactly. And I think that's a great point. So what we're arguing is that the kind of cognitive ways that you process what's happening is actually the key for you to be able to engage in very, you know, complex training. So it's kind of like a package. You basically learn what to pay attention to and what to kind of perceive, and it has two functions. One is that it helps you as, you know, a doctor, you're more aware of the connections between different types of symptoms when you see them. But it also allows you now a way here of reflecting on when you run into problems, how you basically need to change the way you're thinking about something in order to improve your performance.
And this is All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. I'm Maria Tickle. The name Anders Ericsson has become synonymous with the concept of deliberate practice. In the quest to understand what creates world-class expertise, people really at the top of their game, his study professions as diverse as surgery, rhythmic gymnastics, and even chess. But it was his 1993 study of musicians that started the ball rolling.
We were kind of interested in this question here. You know, in music in particular, there's this sense here that some people have, you know, some innate ability here to become musicians. But we wanted to find out, you know, what is it that basically these various musicians, if we take people here who've reached kind of different levels, so we constrain ourselves to people who were full-time music students at an international academy, but according to their teachers, had reached sort of different levels. And then we interviewed them about, you know, their musical history. And in particular, we were interested in this idea here of learning and skill acquisition. So we were focusing in on, you know, how much time had they spent studying music by themselves? And we found that that was interesting because most people enjoy other things more than sitting by themselves. So basically, all the musicians said that they much prefer to kind of make music with their friends than actually sitting by themselves, actually, you know, engaging here in improving their performance.
And it was the top performers, those identified by their teachers as potential international soloists, who reported spending more time doing solo intensive practice right from early on in their careers.
So basically, deliberate practice, the reason why people do it is that they really want to get better. So having the sense here that you're actually improving your performance and thereby increasing your chances here to becoming, you know, a professional musician, I mean, that's what drives the engagement in deliberate practice, as opposed to that it's a, you know, great feeling here to do it.
How did you know that those hours they reported practicing, because they kept diaries, didn't they, that they were actually engaged in this deliberate practice and not sitting in their room playing a tune?
You know, that's a big problem. And what we tried to do was to, one, interview them about what they were actually doing. But secondly, we also had them keep a diary for a whole week so we would be able to assess not just their estimates of how much they studied on an average week, but we could also use now diary estimates. And I think that as you get, as a skilled musician, you basically are really so motivated to improve that you will actually engage in this sort of sequential analysis of trying to master various things. Another factor that I think is interesting is that our music students said that they could only sustain that concentration for about 45 minutes to an hour. So basically, at that point, they felt exhausted, so that now they took a break. We found nobody who was able to sustain kind of this level of focus concentration for more than 4 hours.
So where did the 10,000 hours figure come from?
The 10,000 hours figure came from asking them going back, and we had basically a biographical interview where we asked them when they started playing music and had them estimate then year by year how many hours of practice that they engaged in.
Aren't you relying then on their memory, and don't people tend to kind of overestimate how much practice they might do to make it sound a bit better, or is this kind of retrospective reporting problematic?
Well, obviously you need to be concerned. And basically what we've tried to do is to find converging evidence, like asking parents to give similar kinds of estimates, ask the same student, you know, 1 year later to make the same kind of judgment. People tend to overestimate, but that overestimation is the same for the best musicians as it is for the, you know, sort of the middle group and the least accomplished musicians. So although we maybe are not getting exactly accurate measures, we can still now see the big differences between the different groups. When we look at other domains, you can become the world's best memorizer. And in fact, when we did our research in the late 70s, we trained a college student who was the best in the world on actually remembering numbers that we read to him at a 1 second pace. Now, he only spent, you know, in the order of 200-300 hours to become the world's expert. And if you look at the Guinness Book of World Records, there are all sorts of things that make people special in the whole world that requires way less than 10,000 hours.
But I guess that also depends where the bar is as well. If there's only five people in the world trying to do that kind of memorizing, then it's not that hard to become the world best. Whereas if you're trying to be a 100-meter sprint champion, it's going to be a lot tougher.
Exactly. You know, so basically, you know, what you need to do in order to be the world's best in those domains like music, ballet, and many sports, there obviously the bar has been pushed up. And we've been looking at research where we show that, you know, what you needed to do 100 years ago in order to be the world's best is fundamentally different from what it takes today.
Five world titles.
24 individual World Cup wins.
39 World Cup podiums.
3 world championship medals.
20 years representing Australia.
I have fractured my face in 4 places. Broken my thoracic spine.
Dislocated, fractured my hip.
Elbow reconstruction, shoulder reconstructions, knee reconstruction.
Multiple knee surgeries.
Broken tibia.
It goes on and on and on and on. I've had about as many operations as I have had World Cup wins.
It's a lot.
My name is Jackie Cooper, aerial skier from Melbourne, Australia.
Jackie, what is aerial skiing? Can you describe it for me?
Aerial skiing is a non-traditional Australian sport. It's a winter sport. It's somersaults done at the height of four-storey buildings. So you ski off a ramp at 60, 70 kilometres per hour. You're in the air about 3 seconds performing multiple flips and twists, and you come down and land on a gradient of 38 degrees on a sloped landing hill.
How do you learn to do a move like that? Do you break it down into smaller parts?
Yeah, obviously you don't wake up one day and think, gee, I'm going to attempt a triple twisting, triple somersault. It's a complex move that takes 10, 15 years of work behind it. It's high risk, and so every element of it needs to be perfect. You start every day trying to make small improvements. And the improvements we're talking about, only the coach might be able to see it. But as an athlete, you're doing so much that you can't even see gradual improvement. It takes that long to get so good at any one element. It's just constant, repetitive, repetitive, repetitive work.
My general feeling is that people don't really know what deliberate practice is in sport in the same way that we know in music. There aren't basically this kind of clear hierarchy of skills that you acquire as a violinist. In many sports, gymnastics and diving and ice skating, there is this hierarchy of complex routines that you need to acquire that would make it a little bit more similar to music. And I think in those domains, I think we see the clearer parallels to music. And again, you know, people are performing and you can You don't have to be an expert to see that somebody's not able to do, you know, a very complex dive correctly.
When I tell people that I believe that I wasn't that much of a talented athlete, they're like, oh, don't be ridiculous. You won so many things. And I'm like, yes, that was maybe from a little bit of talent, but it's the stuff that I had inside me that you can't learn, like the heart and the drive and the desire and the persistence and determination, all of that is what gave me a big pool of maybe talent. But the actual talent for acrobatics, I wasn't talented at all.
Hard to believe when you see her in action. Check out her daring jump in thick fog. There's a link on the All in the Mind website. Jackie Cooper there, former world champion aerial skier. And today on ABC Radio National, it's Practice Makes Perfect. Or does it? So what can we mere mortals learn from world-class athletes and the way they train and think? Psychologist Dr. Anders Ericsson, who's researched and written prolifically about expert performance over the past 30 years.
One of the aspects that I often emphasize is that athletes, their ability to actually analyze and control their bodies is a much more remarkable achievement than I think people have traditionally sort of assigned to athletes. It's basically this idea that they're natural, so they kind of just grows to be good at something, whereas the expert performance view is that, you know, they're acquiring all sorts of control structures that allow them now to engage in the appropriate training to get the benefits of that training that will accumulate to their superior performance.
So do you believe there's no such thing as natural talent, that we're all born with the same kind of blank slate or at the same sort of starting point, and then it just depends on the amount and the kind of practice we do in whatever field after that?
At least my understanding is that there's hardly any studies that have looked at high-level performance and related it to genetics. There is now an emerging body of research that, where they basically look at all sorts of individual genes and then try to find a correlation here between the performance of individuals in sports and whether they have this or that gene. Some people find a difference, but then other people try to look for it and can't replicate it. And there may well be that at some point we will have very compelling evidence that individual genes are necessary to reach very high levels. But today, I think I can say here without being too biased that that evidence is not available at this point. I think it's, you know, a scientific issue to pinpoint now. And even if there were some genes that were correlated with performance, perhaps there are other ways in which you can achieve that same performance in just a different way with, you know, a different training approach.
Dr. Anders Ericsson from Florida State University, Tallahassee.
Yeah, everybody comes to the place a little bit differently. You know, there and physics, especially in sports, plays a pretty big role. You know, what genes you have that determine your size make a big difference. But when it comes to getting better, when it comes to a path forward to improvement, everybody does share that same path. Everybody does have to go through that door. They do have to construct their skill through hard, deliberate practice. Somebody can maybe coast along for a while on natural gifts, but in the long run, understanding how that works and understanding how to employ it becomes much, much more important than any gift that you might have received through your genes.
But constructing a skill does mean sculpting the structure of your brain. There is a biological story here. We know that as we learn and remember new skills, the connections between relevant neurons are strengthened. It's that old adage, neurons that fire together, wire together. But as part of his investigation of talent, journalist Dan Coyle spoke to scientists who found that really finessing a skill takes another neurological ingredient.
Myelin is a sheath. It literally forms an electrical tape-like wrapping around the wires of our brain, our axons, the neurons that form chains in our brain. And the myelin is what wraps them. And just like electrical tape wraps any wire, it serves to insulate that electricity. It makes it move faster down the wire, and it prevents it from leaking out into the surrounding tissue. And the magical thing about myelin is that when we practice, we get more of it. And I talked about this with a neurologist at the National Institute of Health, and he referred to myelin as sort of broadband for our brain. You know, every beautiful skill is actually a circuit that's in our brain. Muscles, we talk about muscle memory. Muscles don't actually have memory. Our muscles are very dumb. They only do exactly what our circuits tell them to do. And myelin is how we build fast, accurate circuits. All the speed that we see in motion, all the speed of thought that we see, all the beautiful fluency, that's created by very fast, very accurate electricity. And myelin is the way we make our electricity move faster and more accurately. The scientist mentioned, he said, we have to rewrite the old saying, you know, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes myelin and myelin makes perfect. It was a great study of pianists. And they measured the myelin in their brain before and after several hundred hours of practice. And what they found was that the myelin growth was proportional to the hours of practice. So every hour earned them a certain amount of myelin. Every hour of spent working hard earned them a little more accuracy, a little more speed.
So someone like Tiger Woods, who's been playing golf since he was just out of nappies, would be full of myelin, I'd imagine.
He'd be chock full of myelin. He'd be chock full of other things too, apparently, but myelin is one of them.
Are there critical periods for when we are most able to build myelin?
No, actually, it arrives in a natural wave throughout childhood from the back of the brain to the front, beginning with kind of the motor units and moving toward higher functions. And so there are these ideal periods, which is one of the reasons why you don't see any top soccer players, for instance, who started playing soccer when they were 15. They don't exist. They don't exist because when you're younger, you're able to myelinate and grow these fast, great circuitry that you simply don't have the opportunity to when you're older.
But don't give up hope. You can teach an old dog new tricks. And myelination doesn't stop either as we age. It's just that fresh, young brains have an advantage.
You know, we grow up being told over and over and over by our parents in books and movies that talent is given out at birth. It's such a magical story, and we all relate to it because it turns ourselves into a treasure box. We wonder what sort of divine spark we contain. But once you learn about the way the brain actually works, and once you learn about the way skill is actually constructed, you begin to pay attention to other parts of life. You begin to pay attention to things you didn't notice before. You begin to pay attention to little differences in passion. You begin to pay attention to little differences in the way people practice. When you stop seeing it as a possession and start seeing it as something that we all can build, it's sort of more of a democratic vision and more of an exciting vision in a way. And when you see little hotbeds of people who are all sort of thinking in the same direction, all practicing the same way, and who can get to be successful, maybe it doesn't seem as sort of magical as if, you know, God had given them those abilities, but it's beautiful in its own way. And I think it's exciting because I think it speaks to the potential that we all have. The human brain is very, very, very big. 100 billion possible connections, more than there are stars in the sky. And so this idea that we can grow this thing and can figure out how it grows and grow it in our families, in our sports teams, in our schools, is much more exciting than this idea that we all sort of have a lottery ticket that we scratch off and see if we're smart or brilliant or not.
Everyone's a winner, baby, that's the truth.
Journalist and author of The Talent Code, Dan Coyle, speaking to producer Maria Tickle. And just a clarification, there are in fact around 100 billion neurons in the brain, which makes for 100 trillion possible connections, even more impressive potential there. Catch more info about our guests and their work on our website and join the conversation there too. Look for Add Your Comment at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind on this week's page. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks to studio engineer Alex Stinson. And thanks for your company too. Catch you next week.
We should stand up for the poor. We should stand up for the most vulnerable, the most needy. Technology already benefits those who are well off, exceptionally well. And if I can do something to bridge the digital divide and help the poorest and most vulnerable, then that's something that's actually very satisfying for me personally to do.
Should a telephone call be a human right and not a privilege? Communication, access and equality. That's Future Tense, and you can download or stream the program from the Radio National website.